Temple Grandin, Ph.D., is probably the most accomplished adult with autism in the world. Now a designer of livestock handling facilities and a professor of animal science at Colorado State University, Dr. Grandin didn't speak until she was 3.5 years old. Labeled autistic, her parents were told she should be institutionalized. But today, roughly 50% of the beef that shows up on your plate came through improvements that she has made to the process of livestock management. Consulting for firms such as Burger King, McDonald's, Swift, and others, Grandin has become a prominent author, speaker, and advocate on the issues of autism and Asperger's syndrome because she has made a career of overcoming obstacles that have been placed in her path. She tells her story in the book Emergence, labeled autistic, and is also the author of Animals Make Us Human, Animals in Translation, Thinking in Pictures, and other reports from my life with autism, and her latest, The Way I See It. Welcome, Temple Grandin.
Well, it's really good to be here.
Thank you, and thank you for taking the time here during the holiday season. I like listeners to get a feel for the people behind the work and the ideas that we talk about. Now, in your case, it seems to me your personal story is crucial to your work and your role in society. So please share a bit about your early history and, if you would, the actions and the decisions by you and others that made your current life possible.
Well, when I was a very little kid, I had very good early educational intervention. I had a great speech teacher who started working with me when I was 2.5 years old. I had a nanny who played constant turn-taking games with me and my sister. Little autistic kids, you got to keep them engaged. And we got the Parcheesi board, and I had to learn how to take turns. When I was in high school, I had a fantastic science teacher. I was a student that was just kind of lost and messing around in school and didn't care about school. And Mr. Carlock, my science teacher, gave me a reason to study. You might be interested to know that in the HBO movie they're making about me, Mr. Carlock's got an honorary doctorate. He's going to be Dr. Carlock in the movie.
Good for him.
And I think he deserves that because he was one of those teachers that gave me a reason to study because now I had a goal of becoming a scientist. And we've got to work with kids on developing areas of strength. You know, my ability in art when I was just a little kid was always encouraged and developed. And I was encouraged to paint pictures and draw pictures of many, many different things and learn how to do art projects kind of on assignment. You know, these kids have got to learn how to do things that are useful to other people. But I can't emphasize enough for young autistic kids the importance of early educational intervention. Worst thing you could do with an autistic two-year-old is let them sit in the corner all day and do nothing.
And I believe, if I'm not mistaken, you were allowed to sit in the corner and do nothing or to do your repetitive behaviors or something for an hour a day.
That's it. I was allowed to do it for an hour after lunch, and the rest of the time I had to be tuned in with Miss Manners' meals. And if I was, combing my hair with my fork, you know, that got stopped in a great big hurry. And, you know, if that hadn't been done, I wouldn't be here now. And I also want to talk about how I think in pictures. My mind works sort of like Google for images. You know, if you say something to me, a keyword, I just see images flashing into my mind. And why don't you just pretend I'm Google for pictures, and I'll explain to you how I think. Give me a keyword, something that's not in my office.
Zebra.
Zebra? Well, I'm seeing the business card that's on my wall of a lady that works with zebras. I'm seeing a zebra that I saw one time in a livestock auction. I'm seeing a zebra that I saw down in South Africa that had decided he wanted to live with the horses. This was out at a wildlife preserve. You know, I'm starting to see slides of zebras, sort of coming up like a series of PowerPoint slides, you know, each one on the screen for about half a second in my mind.
Now, let me ask you something, because I don't believe I see in pictures. I think I think in pictures. So for me, I eventually will see the zebra, but in other words, I think you've said that I might start with the idea or the word and then move to the picture, whereas for you, the picture appears and you have to then move toward the word or the idea?
Well, it's yes, and it's a specific zebra. There's no generic zebra. I always knew I thought in pictures, but when I wrote my book, Thinking in Pictures, I made up some interview questions, and I was shocked to find out how some people answered them. And I said, think about a church steeple. And I was shocked to find out that some people get this very vague, sort of generalized steeple image. I only get specific ones, and they just come up like a slide, and I can name where they're located around town. There is no generalized church steeple. There's only specific ones.
Right. And what they're doing is they're saying, okay, a steeple is something tall, pointed, and so on, and they kind of get the criteria or something, perhaps,
and
for a steeple.
And they sometimes see a vague image.
Yeah.
And I talked to one speech therapist that had no visual thinking at all, and she just heard the bell.
Uh-huh.
She was totally an auditory thinker. And the thing is, if I ask you something like car or house, everybody visualizes their own car or house.
Sure.
But the reason for picking out the steeple is it's something that you see all the time, but most people don't pay any attention to them. But they're out there, and you have to see them.
Mm-hmm. So people know what they are, but they may not see a particular one. This is fascinating stuff to me. Let me jump back to one thing. You said that Mr. Carlock gave you something worth living for. He gave you the notion, I guess, that you could become a scientist. How did that happen? What was it that you indicated that made him say you could be a scientist? And was the fact that you could now look ahead years in advance, was that something new to you?
Well, he got me a lot of interesting projects for me to do. I was fascinated with optical illusions, and he got me all these optical illusions. And then he said, if you want to really find out how different things work, then you've got to study the scientific literature. And he introduced me to searching the scientific literature. And in the 60s, this was work.
Yeah,
you had to go to the library and look it up in these great big huge books that were like giant dictionaries of abstracts. And we didn't even have a copier machine. The abstracts had to be copied out onto index cards and put in a file like you keep recipes in. I mean, it was a ton of work. But I was fascinated with, you know, finding journal articles. And now it's just so easy. I can just go down on a computer and I can do that. But not in the 60s, you couldn't do that. And, you know, there's a lot of, you know, students that are kind of floundering around. And, you know, and a good teacher can get a kid, you know, headed off in the right direction.
Something that you know that probably most people don't are the different kinds of thinking that people do. In other words, you mentioned there's oral thinking. What are the different types of thinking?
Well, I have found, like, on a lot of kind of quirky kind of kids, they'll have uneven skills. They'll be really good at one thing and really terrible at something else. I'm a photorealistic visual thinker, and I want to emphasize that there's other people that would have no autism that can also have this kind of thinking. And I was absolutely horrible at algebra, because in algebra there was nothing to visualize. And the mistake that was made with me is I never got a chance to try geometry. And I'm fine when I talk about this at conferences. I have all kinds of people coming up to me and say, well, I had that problem too. And then another kind of thinker is the pattern thinking mind. It's kind of a more abstract visual thinker. Think origami, think chess, things like that, where it's kind of more abstract patterns. You know, these are your people that would be good at computer programming, and I was absolutely, you know, couldn't do computer programming because it's too abstract. And these people often have problems with reading. And then there's this, the word mind, maybe more like yours, that thinks, you know, more in words. And they can be mixtures of minds. But, you know, the kind of, you know, autistic and Asperger-y kind of kids, that there tends to be uneven skills. They're good at one thing, bad at something else. And oftentimes educators put way too much emphasis on the deficits and not enough emphasis on the area of strength.
Right.
Strengths that can turn into good careers.
In other words, in your case, it was your visual thinking that ended up, as I said in the intro, leading you to see the world more as animals do. Before we get into that, let me ask a couple of questions for people who kind of hear the notions but don't really know what they mean. What is autism? What is Asperger's? What's that continuum?
You know, autism is a continuum that just, you know, a very big continuum going from very severe, where the person will remain nonverbal and have to live in a supervised living situation, all the way up to very brilliant scientists. And it's a continuum of traits. I mean, the core trait is, you know, sort of lack of social relatedness. But some of the kids are very, very smart. Asperger's is just simply the milder variant of autism. That's all Asperger's is.
And what defines autism as autism? What defines, say, okay, that falls in that continuum?
Basically, if you follow the guidelines as they're written right now, the child has to be nonverbal, you know, no speech, and have also autistic behaviors like no social interaction, no eye contact, a lot of tantrums, repetitive behavior, you know, lack of a social relatedness. It's very obvious when the kid is less than 3 years old that there's something drastically wrong with the child other than the lack of speech.
And the repetitive behaviors, I believe I've heard you say, is not necessarily something in itself. It's something to relieve stress?
Yeah, basically, you know, I would do it to relieve stress because loud sounds hurt my ears like a dentist drill hitting a nerve. You know, I had to wear scratchy petticoats when I was a little kid, and that just was absolutely, you know, horrible. And I talk about these things in my book, Thinking in Pictures.
Right. And so, but by doing certain repetitive behaviors, sounds like it's almost like physical meditating. In other words, you're focusing on something else than the thing that's bothering you.
Well, that's right. But the problem is if you let the kid do that all day,
yes,
then their brain's not going to develop.
Right.
One thing to let them do it a little bit to calm down. And I was given some downtime where I was allowed to do these behaviors.
Yeah.
But then the rest of the time, I had to be tuned in.
So I can see what some people might do is it's too much trouble to deal with them and try to lead them out of that. So they just go, go ahead and just do it. Because if their better behavior keeps them quiet, let them do it. But in fact, what you're saying is that reinforces itself and makes it harder and harder for them to emerge from it.
Well, yes. And the thing that's important with the real little kids, the 2, 3, 4, and 5-year-olds, is they need to get 20 or 40 hours a week of instruction with one-to-one with an effective teacher. There's a lot of controversy over which methods they're going to use. The thing that really matters isn't whether this technique or that technique. It's keeping the kid engaged with a lot of interactive activity. And with me when I was a child, it was turn-taking games and teaching table manners and having to have table manners at the table.
Because that makes you deal with the social reality of the other person?
Well, and also you have to learn that there is another person. You've got to take turns. I've just got to learn to do things. You see, being an autistic person, you have to learn social behavior like being in a play. It's sort of like in that movie Avatar, and they're going to the other planet, and they're trying to learn how the natives think. In fact, Oliver Sacks' book was called Anthropologist on Mars because
that was your expression, wasn't it?
It was my expression. That's right.
Yeah. And let me just ask a couple of other questions in this early stuff because I do want to let people get a feel for this. When did you know and that your brain or the way you saw the world was different, and when did you begin to be able to see your way out of that?
Well, when I was a little kid, when I was in high school, I thought everybody thought in pictures. I thought everybody thought in pictures, and I didn't realize the full extent of how my mind was different until I did my book, Thinking in Pictures. And I figured out this question about the church steeples, because that's something that's out there in the environment, everybody sees them, but they don't pay that much attention to them. Where if I asked house or car, they see their own house, their own car.
Okay, it certainly seems that the incidence of the whole autism continuum is increasing. What is your sense of why that might be so, and do you think it's really happening or that we're just noticing more? And if it is happening, why do you think that is?
Well, I think some of it's just increased diagnosis.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm seeing a lot of things where a lot more manic depression or bipolar is getting diagnosed, and I think some of that's just BS. Things are getting, the Asperger's kids, they've always been here. I mean, they're geeks and nerds. I mean, you wouldn't even have a radio station if you didn't have, people a little bit on the Asperger spectrum to keep your radio station going. It's that simple. We've got to have those people. These are the people that are more interested in things than interested in people. But I think there's been some severe autism that's increased, and I don't think that's increased diagnosis, and that's the type of autism where the kid appears to develop normally and then around 18 months of age loses language.
Right.
The so-called regressive autism. That's gone up.
Okay.
Where the Asperger's and some of that, I'm seeing, that's always been here. I'm seeing kids coming into meetings now that they're real, real super mild. They're just a little bit geeky and a little bit not social. And I think today's sort of looser social life is bad. You see, when we were little kids, everybody was taught manners. Everybody was taught, say please and thank you.
Yep.
And where today they're not. And they're supposed to sort of just learn it by osmosis. And the autistic kid's not going to learn it that way.
Something I became aware of, let me tell people, by the way, I'm speaking with Temple Grandin. She is, as you've been hearing, she's someone who was born with autism and yet is a professor at Colorado State University and a designer of livestock handling facilities and the author of a number of books. The latest two are Animals Make Us Human and The Way I See It. You can learn more about most of her work at templegrandin.com and about her livestock work at grandin.com. I recently was introduced to the work of the person that I saw talking about it was Aditi Shankardas, who uses SPECT scans, and she has discovered that some people who were diagnosed with autism actually were suffering from seizures, and that when they took seizure medication, they were okay, and that they didn't have autism at all.
That is true. In fact, I wrote about that in Thinking in Pictures in the first edition back in 1995. Now, that's not seizure medication isn't going to do me any good.
Right.
But there are some where seizure medication works.
Now, are
also,
they
there are some where special diets like casein and gluten-free also work.
Right. So, in other words, are they... I mean, their developmental problem is actually, in one case, dietary, or is that, are they still autistic, or is it that they're displaying autistic behavior because of a different root cause?
There's a lot of things that are not known. Epilepsy, you know, if you look at the incidence of epilepsy, you know, starting at puberty, people on the autism spectrum have a much higher incidence of epilepsy. I mean, I've never had any epileptic stuff. You know, this is going to be variable, and this is especially things like the seizure medications working. I think that's going to be more likely in the regressive type of autism, because that's also the type of autism where the special diets tend to do the most good.
Okay. So let's move on to the other thing, which is that you discovered, remember we've said that what you want to do is you want to build on the strengths of someone with autism or Asperger's, and what you're saying was, so how has your personal experience and the way you see the world translated to your greater understanding of animals?
Well, an animal is a sensory-based thinker. An animal is not a language-based thinker. It's, you know, he's a visual thinker, he's an auditory thinker, he's a smell thinker, he's a touch thinker. It's very detailed sensory information. And as I learned more and more and more about how my thinking was different, I go, well, that has to be the way an animal thinks. And then I started talking to people and finding out, well, their horse was afraid of a black hat, or their horse was afraid of naked white saddle pads with no saddle on top. And I go, wait a minute, these are visual things, and they're very specific visual things, because the horse that was afraid of black cowboy hats was absolutely fine and liked white cowboy hats just fine. You see, that's a different picture.
Yeah.
It's a very specific sensory-based thinking. And I'd start, you know, doing talks on animal behavior, and all these people would come up and say, well, my horse is afraid of long-handled tools like shovels and rakes. You know, because somebody had, you know, he'd had bad experience with something that was long and skinny.
And so he just remembered long and skinny fear.
Long and skinny. So, you know, other things that might make him afraid might be a cane, a show stick, a microphone stand, you know, anything that's long and skinny.
So, and then... when did you make the leap from, well, if I can see like an animal, perhaps I can help the way we treat animals?
Well, when I in the early 70s, when I still thought everybody thought in pictures, the first thing I did with animals is I went out to these big feed yards where they had to vaccinate thousands and thousands of cattle. And they were, people were very rough with the cattle, and the cattle were afraid to go through the facilities. And I found that they were balking at shadows, they were balking at a chain hanging down, they were balking at seeing a truck going by. And I watched the animals. I could see what they were doing. I'd get down the chutes and find these distractions that were making the animals spook, and other people just weren't seeing that. And I go, well, can't you see that? Mm-hmm. I mean, even today, and I've written checklists up, like Animals in Translation has a whole checklist of the things to take out of facilities that can make animals be afraid, like a little piece of a loose chain end hanging down. You know, why after 35 years I have to keep talking about chain ends? People don't take them out. The normal language-based mind drops out the details, and there's actually been brain scan research on that.
That makes very good sense. In other words, to them, the relevance of that hanging piece of chain just doesn't exist in the idea of chain. So, in other words, what you did was, in the way that you could see and thus empathize with the experience of the animal, you could say, well, if we just did this differently, the animal would calm down or the animal would be comfortable. What are some of the changes that have been made on a large scale across the country around the globe because of your insights?
Well, I first of all, you know, started working on showing people how to take these distractions out of facilities. You know, then I went around to all many, many different ranches and feed yards and handled cattle, and I came up with, you know, better designs for facilities. And when I first started in my career, I thought I could fix everything with just equipment, if I could just build the perfect system. Well, I found I could only fix half of it with equipment. The other half is the management. And what I've observed over the years is that about 20% of people can keep their livestock handling good and not be hitting and not be yelling and screaming.
And you still get
a lot of other people tend to slowly lapse back into rough handling.
Mm-hmm.
So the biggest thing I've worked on in the last 10 years was a scoring system for scoring handling. So then I can tell, is this cattle handling worsening or is this cattle handling getting better?
Mm-hmm.
And you score simple things. How many fall down? How many a bellerin? How many got the electric prodder put on them? How many, you know, smashed into a gate? Those are things I can count. And then I can tell, are they getting better or are they getting worse? And this has been very successful because this scoring system is, you know, McDonald's started, you know, been using that now for 10 years. A lot of governments use it. Because if you just say in a guideline or a regulation, avoid excessive electric produce, I mean, what does that mean?
Exactly.
What does that mean? It means something totally different to different people.
Right. Yeah, well, yeah, exactly. And there's a big term in management that if you can't count it, it doesn't count. But
well,
when
I've
you
been
can
using that term, you manage what you measure.
Exactly.
And if more than one animal out of 100 falls, you know, in a meat plant, that's a failed McDonald's audit.
Mm-hmm.
Period. And another thing I've been working on just recently has been video auditing.
Sure.
Where auditors over the internet can tune in any time and see what they're doing at this plant. And that solves the problem of people faking good when the auditor's there.
Of course, of course. And finally, you know, there's been, whether it's Michael Pollan's work or Jonathan Furr's new book, Eating Animals, that have basically said that the treatment of animals just isn't humane. What's your sense about that? In other words, obviously you've worked for the large corporations that now dominate the cattle industry.
Well, when I first started out working with cattle, there was some atrocious cattle handling, absolutely atrocious. But the thing that kept me going is that there were a few people, even some big feed yards and some ranches, that actually did things right. I call them my believers. And there was a beautiful ranch in Arizona when I was in my cattle formative years,
uh-huh,
where cattle were really handled right. And they had a great life living out on the ranch. And even the feed yard cattle, it was dry in Arizona, you didn't have mud, they had shades. Handling was atrocious, but the living conditions were pretty decent. And I could see that cattle really could be raised right. Now, if in the early 70s, if my first introduction to livestock had been egg layer chickens and big, long, ammonia-laden barns, my career might have taken a different route.
Mm-hmm.
But I started out with cattle, and I could see that cattle done right can really be, you know, the most humane. The animals that have the most problems are the egg layer hen and pigs. Those are the animals now where there's the most welfare problems.
Okay, so people should know that. There might be environmental reasons to avoid cattle meat, but in terms of handling and humanity, it's the poultry and the pigs. Finally, let me, because we've got about 30 seconds more, what would you say to someone today who's they get a diagnosis of autism or Asperger's in their child?
Well,
30 seconds.
The autistic kid, if it's a 2-year-old or 3-year-old, hours and hours of early intervention. If it's an Asperger kid, kind of a geek and nerd kid, develop his areas of strength. We've got to start doing a whole lot more on getting kids into good careers. I have another little book called Developing Talents, which is strictly on careers for people with autism and Asperger's.
Very good. We've been speaking with Temple Grandin, a designer of livestock handling facilities, professor of animal science at Colorado State University, who has had since birth autism. Her latest books are The Way I See It and Animals Make Us Human. You can learn more at templegrandin.com and at grandin.com. Thank you, Temple Grandin. Keep up the good work.
Well, thank you so much for having me.